Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt.
Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood receiver pressure increases. It's at full.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
And welcome to
Jesus, somebody let go of the dead tone switch. Okay. How are you?
Not too bad. How about yourself?
I'm okay. You know, just like I said before we were talking, just enjoying this beautiful Southern California afternoon.
And that would be our guest, Mark Scheffler.
Yes, our guest, Mark Scheffler. I'm Steve. Gonna go sit back and just let y'all talk. I mean, y'all already started. But as usual, well, it was supposed to be by popular demand, but I still had to have Carl back. So, in spite of popular demand, here is the one, the only Carl Kafer.
Greetings, salutations. We are doing this special podcast in memory of someone that was very influential, particularly in the comedy arena. And we're
very
talking, of course.
You're understating it.
That's an understatement, and we'll get to that, of course.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Mitzi Shore, and we have Adam, Mark Scheffler. I keep mixing you with Adam Schefter. Never mind. But Mark Scheffler.
Go in the corner.
Yes.
Sit down for a second, please. This is Mark
Scheffler,
actor, writer, and comic who worked at the Comedy Store.
Right.
Say hello, Mark.
Hello there.
And
so,
if they were
so
an
Mark,
understatement,
how, okay,
put it this
ahead,
way,
Steve.
There would not be any comedy boom, pretty much, if it wasn't for Mitzi Shore. There wouldn't be any late-night wars in the 80s with Letterman versus Leno without Mitzi Shore.
Hang on. I don't think that's a completely accurate statement. There were comedy clubs before the Comedy Store. There was, and the Improv in New York had been going on since the 60s, since the middle 60s. But and then Bud moved out here to L.A., not to diminish Mitzi's contribution one bit, but she was pretty much in on the ground level of comedy in Los Angeles, and the entertainment industry, the home of the entertainment industry is Los Angeles. So she was a very smart woman in the right place at the right time.
And you guys were lucky she got divorced and got the club in the divorce.
Yeah, that is true. Well, she was married to a comedian by the name of Sammy Shore. I just about, I don't know, 6 months ago maybe, they had a 90th birthday party for Sammy at the Comedy Store, and I was lucky enough to be invited to that. So he got up on stage and, you know, did like 10 minutes, and he was terrific. But, yeah, she, in their divorce settlement, he gave her the store, and she pretty much built it from, you know, from that moment to what it's become.
There was an interview about 7 or 8 years ago with Sammy, and he said he basically gave her the store so he could lessen the alimony payments, and that's why he did it. And then he said in the interview, oh, boy, was that a mistake for me and an absolute boon for Mitzi.
Well, you know, that may be what Sammy said, but I don't know if you could actually say that, because there's no guarantee that had that not happened, that that club that the would have become what it became. It became what it became precisely because Mitzi's hands were all over it. You know, it was was an extension, you know, of her, and you know, I have very fond memories. I mean, you know, I was a lucky person, you know, so my relationship with her was always very friendly. I wasn't the closest comedian in her orbit, but I wasn't, you know, Pluto either. You know, I wasn't out in the hinterlands either. Pretty much.
So you're a young comic, Mark, and you come to New York. I mean, you come to L.A. How did you get involved, or how did you get a gig at the Comedy Store, and how did you first meet Mitzi?
I was an unusual circumstance. I wasn't exactly like a lot of the younger comics that started there. What happened with me was, prior to even coming to L.A., when I was in my early 20s, I was a road manager, part of his act, for a comedian by the name of London Lee, who used to do an act based on his family's wealth. He was known as the rich kid comedian. Well, his father, really, this guy, London Lee, did the Ed Sullivan Show and the Merv Griffin Show. He was an East Coast comic, did the Catskill Mountains a lot. But he made me part of his act. Not only was I, you know, his kind of road manager, but for about a year and a half, I was also part of his act. And during that time, we played everywhere from the Catskill Mountains to the Steel Pier in Atlantic City to the Copacabana in New York. And so I'm actually one of the last remaining comedians who can say that they were on stage at the Copacabana doing shows. So when I got to L.A. because I sold a script that I wrote, and that moved me here. And in a meeting with my agents at William Morris back then, they asked me what else I wanted to do. Was there anything else I wanted to do? So I said, well, I did stand-up back in New York, and I'd like to do that again. So what they were able to do was they got me a time on Monday night, on open mic night, but they got me a specific time. I didn't have to stand in line. So I went on, and I did like a good 5 minutes, and I went back, and that's how I did it. I mean, otherwise, you got to stand in line. I hear it's impossible these days. That you got to stand in line, and you know, it's a process. You got to really want it. You know, I got there, and from the time I started going on stage, like that first Monday night, I hung out there almost every day, and I got to suss out the whole hierarchy, who Mitzi was, you know, and you know, I managed to, like, the second week to get in her field of vision, just walking by, and I did it another Monday night, and I ended up doing like 3 Monday nights, and she was in the audience on the 4th Monday night, and she was showcasing another comedian. And the way it worked was, you had to do a bunch of Monday nights, some, you know, depending on how you were progressing, for, you know, until she decided that she was going to showcase you, till the word filtered up to her that she was going to showcase you, which means she was going to come down and watch you do your 5 minutes or whatever. So she happened to be in the audience the night that one night showcasing somebody else, and I was on ahead of that person, and I did a fucking great 5 minutes. I did, you know, and I walked off the stage, and I was thinking to myself, it's not going to get any better than this, you know. You know, so I just went up to her, and I said, hey, Mitzi, what's going on now? Is that good enough? And she looked at me. And I caught her by surprise or whatever, however it happened. She put her arm on my arm and said, okay, Mark, call in for spots. And that was how I became a regular.
Nice. So you had a little chutzpah there. Good for you.
Well, you have to. That's the thing. Listen, Mitzi Shore was brilliant at what she did, but she was like one of the original multitaskers. So whenever you saw her, whatever she was always doing something else in her head. So if you got her in her field of vision and you wanted to talk to her, you had about 10 seconds to convince her that second number 11 deserved to exist.
Gotcha. So once you got into the Monday nights and you got to be a regular, how did that all work? And how did you see Mitzi, you know, in running the place and so on and so forth? What was your perception?
You have to kind of like, you know, let me tell you tell you the first night I did a regular spot. The first night I did a regular spot was on a Tuesday in April. This is almost 42 years ago, because it was April of 76. And I say almost because I think it was like the third or fourth Tuesday of April. So I'm nervous. I had a house in Laurel Canyon about a mile and a half away from the Comedy Store. I drove down, parked my car, and I go in the back of the parking lot of the Comedy Store, and I light up a joint. I'm smoking by myself, and I'm just back there and just going over my material. And I see George Miller come walking down the walkway from the Sunset Boulevard side to the back door of the Comedy Store. He sees me, and he comes right over. Now, I know who, you know, you guys know who George Miller was, right?
Yeah, I know who George Miller was.
Okay.
You might want to tell all the people,
though. Just checking. So, and he had already been on The Tonight Show, and he was like, you know, like a serious, well-known comedian. So he comes up, and he introduces himself and said, is that pot? And I said, yeah. He said, can I have some? And I said, yeah. And he tasted it, and he said, wow, we're going to be good friends. Puts his arm around me, and we walk into the Comedy Store, and we pass an old pickup truck with Indiana license plates on it. And he said, oh, yeah, my friend Dave's here. Come meet my friend Dave. He's a comedian, too. So I went in, and the first night I met Letterman. It was the first night there. The point of it is, once you got in that membrane, once you permeated that outer area, you were now part of a family. And back in those days, the whole goal in life, every day for the most part, maybe not Sunday or Monday, but every other day, was to end up at the Comedy Store that night. So it was a central part of our lives.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Now
think,
you know, I've heard
let me say
stories.
Something.
And,
I read.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, in the Comedy Store documentary, I forget it was, Belzer talks about one night he walked in the club and he seen Mitzi, and she was doing the book, talking to the bartender what the specials were going to be that night, and keeping an eye on the comics that were working on the stage at
mm-hmm.
the same time.
Yep. Doesn't surprise me. It does not surprise. She was a sharp cookie. Let me tell you. I can't understate how sharp she was. And she had her favorites, and then, you know, like, I read a lot and talk to people since she passed away. You know, people were saying that there were people who were really funny who, you know, she didn't give a chance to. Well, in reality, if you're really funny, just because Mitzi Shore didn't give you a chance, you would find a way to make your career happen. That's the way it works. So it makes somebody want something just a little bit more. So I don't buy the whole say, you know, once you got there, once you got up on that stage, then it was your career to you know, make happen one or not make happen.
Right.
Yeah, because
you know, what?
Yeah, wasn't there like Catch a Rising Star? Some of the other big ones that.
There was Catch a Rising Star in New York. There was a comic strip in New York. But in reality, when Bud opened up out here, Bud Friedman talking about from the Improv, when he opened up out here, he and Mitzi became, those two places became like the premier places for anyone in the comedy world to be seen by anyone in the industry. Okay, that's it. That's the way it worked. You know, if you had any kind of talent that was coming out of you at the moment, when you got up on stage at the Comedy Store the first time, it wouldn't take more than 3 months for somebody on the other side of the business, in management or an agency person, to approach you. I had been on the stage at the Comedy Store for 6 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, when another comic's manager, a comic I knew, came up to me and said, "My manager wants to talk to you." And they ended up being my managers for several years and helped my career immensely. So it didn't take long for that to happen, because back in those days, the way it was, I don't really know if it works the same way now, but back in those days, people looking for talent would just flood the Comedy Stores and the Improv at night. And that's, you know, the Improv is more social. The Improv on Melrose, much more social, because there's a bar area. The Comedy Store has the bar area outside, but it's more touristy.
Okay. Gotcha.
So.
Gotcha. Now, Mitzi, you know, I've heard that, of course, you have told us before, you know, her name or nickname was Mom or Ma.
Yeah,
and she was very much a mother figure to most of these comics. What did she do for certain comics? I mean,
depending on her perception of your state of need, okay? Like, if you needed a place to live, Mitzi was, you know, she'd find places for people. If you were in her orbit, she was kind of a tough, lovey kind of woman. She would take care of you. And as far as the whole mother thing is concerned, yeah, she was. I mean, we were all misfits. We were all fucking misfits, all of us. All of us, Jay and Letterman and Robin and Tom Dreesen, all of us. All of us were fucking misfits. Billy Miller, we were all fucking people who, you know, didn't belong anywhere else except here. And she allowed us to be okay. She's kind of, you know, said, this matriarchal woman said, "You guys are okay. I like you. We're going to have," and it became like a family. It became like an extended family. You know, I interact a lot with comedians from that era, you know, my friends, because we, you know, it's a version of combat. We were in foxholes together, only the foxholes were, you know, comedy stages in L.A.
Yeah, it's amazing. We'll go through it at the end of the thing. How many comics were involved with the Comedy Store?
Yeah,
but you know, go ahead.
Let me clarify something. When I say that there wouldn't have been a late night war without her, I basically am saying Leno and Letterman both got their start with Mitzi.
Yeah. Yes. More so David than Jay. Jay was working at the Improv quite a bit.
Yeah.
But getting back to Mitzi, you know, she'd find a place for you to stay and maybe get you some food if you needed or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the one thing that really, in researching her, that really impressed me, and I wondered if you knew much about this either, was, you know, she really started Comedy Central.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. I mean, she was literally right on the tip of the spear of the comedy revolution in the 70s. She was.
Yeah,
she,
and one of the reasons that her and Bud got divorced, Carl, wanted to showcase the new comics.
She didn't get divorced from Bud. She got divorced from a comedian by the name of Sammy Short.
Well, Sammy, yeah. But that was one of the big reasons they got divorced, because of that dichotomy. He wanted to keep his old friends on the stage, and she wanted to inject new blood.
Mitzi was always looking to the future. You know, she had her eye on the future. She had her eye on everybody's future. That's how she judged. She would just look at somebody, and if they had a future, if she thought they were funny and she thought they had a future, she would, you know, help them develop.
Well, you know, I mean, how lucky were these comedians to have someone like that? I mean, that's an amazing, amazing
yeah.
gift to anyone who's trying to make it in comedy. Trust me.
You're right. You're 100% right. It is. It was, you know, it was a time like no other. I mean, everybody says that about their generation, but if you look back historically into the comedy revolution of the mid-70s, that's the epicenter of it. You know, that and the improv, those are the epicenters of the comedy revolution. And I don't know if 35, 40 years from now, people will look back and look at this time period and at the talent that sprung forth from now and say, you know, wow, is that the same? Is that different? Is, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like there's those touch points like the Comedy Store and the Improv anymore.
Well, I mean, the Comedy Store is still there, you know, and still functions. But, like, I have a friend who still works there occasionally, and he said to me that the big difference is that now, back in our day, you would go to the Comedy Store and get up on stage and try to, from that, get on a TV show. He said, now there are people who are on TV shows who are getting on TV shows to try to get spots at the Comedy Store. And while that sounds cool, that's kind of like inverted performance development. You know, it's like because it's at the Comedy Store and places like that where you work the kinks out of who you are and your material. So if
right.
you don't have a place to do that and you're only floating in on celebrity and you don't have a behind that, you know, an amount of writing and performance and development and process, you sometimes fall on your ass, you know?
Falling on your ass is part of the deal, but you're supposed to fall on your ass and then get up and do better the next time, not,
yeah.
you know, have some sort of celebrity and then come in and float on that and then fall on your ass. That's
right.
a whole different thing.
Yeah. And I've heard many stories back in the day of comedians about to get on stage and they're saying, oh, you're going to have to go on an hour late. Pryor wants to test out some new jokes.
Yeah, that happened. Yeah, that's just part of it. That's the way it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if you
Pryor
had new material or
jokes or maybe, yeah, he would be one of those that would test out jokes for 6 months. Before he'd even tell them on one of his big tours or a movie or a stage.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, that's the other thing that you had. It was sort of like a university.
Yes.
It was like a school where you'd go in and you'd try stuff and it didn't work and so on and so forth. You'd hone your craft and Mitzi would probably give you some pointers and other comedians would give you some pointers.
How about
and
the
you
audience?
Work and work and call
the audience gives you pointers. If they don't laugh, it's not funny.
That's true.
And if you think it's funny and they're not laughing, then you got to examine how you're saying the joke. Maybe there's something you can do to improve the joke. I do that now. Sometimes I know I've written a good joke. I may not have the wording right, and I only get to that point by hearing it out on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
And so of all the comedians that were in your sphere, were there, you know, I know you turned out to be a writer of
yes.
jokes. Did you run across comedians that aren't as well known as someone like Robin Williams who, you know, learned their craft and became writers like you?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of people, you know, Judd Apatow. He was younger than me, not part of my generation, but he became a writer. Mike Binder became a writer for the most part. Mike Preminger, Rick Podell. Let me see. Barry Martyr, Marty Nadler, who did Laverne and Shirley for many years. A lot of people just became writers. You just learned learn that craft.
You know, the reason I bring that up is because, you know, you look at the Comedy Store, and most people listening to this are going to think of Robin Williams or thinking of Richard Pryor, and are thinking of those people.
Yeah,
but
my name,
the influence is much more than that.
Well, then,
you know,
if you look at the wall of the Comedy Store, you know, where all the names are, you get a real kind of historic. That's a real good way of putting the store in its historical context, because Mitzi, I didn't even realize until, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago when Lou Deck told me what her process was. She went through like a really deep process on deciding whose names would go up on the wall. My name's been up there since, I think, 1978. So 40 years on the wall. And only in the last few years when I came to understand, because for me, when the name started going up, it was just all my friends. You know, there were a few people who were older than me, and I guess they had been there in the early days. I got there in 76. So I sort of was taking it for granted all this time. I no longer take it for granted. I now realize that it tells me every time I see it that I didn't hear about those days, and I didn't read about those days, and I didn't see those days in a movie or in a TV show. I lived those days. There's the proof. it's kind of humbling, actually.
Well,
and you're
know,
right, there never will be a time like then, because at its peak, you know, like 85 or so, 90, every little boondock town, even Knoxville, Tennessee, which is not that big, is a college town, had like 10 or 12 comedy clubs in it.
Yeah.
You'll never see anything like that again.
Nope. No, you're right.
No, and the thing I was trying to make a point was, you know, it's television, it's film, all these writers and all these performers, you know, what a vast pool of talent came through there and how much they have influenced our whole entertainment industry from the 70s on, even till now.
Oh, absolutely.
And further on.
No, it's
Oh, and I got a question. Why is it that I've read a lot of comics, one of the first things they bragged about is not that they got on stage at the Comedy Store, is that they worked the door. What was why was that such an honor to be hired to work the door at the Comedy
Store?
It's not
that it was an honor. It's that it was the first step that a lot of people took. It's like one day you're not in the entertainment business, the next day you're the doorman at the improv or the Comedy Store, but now you're in the entertainment business. It's a significant thing for someone. I have a comedian friend of mine, Joey Gaynor, who I've known since those days, and Joey is very proud of the fact that he and Sam Kinison worked at the Comedy Store together, and he was part of Sam's crew. So it's a rite of passage for some people, and the guys who share that are very close with you, mostly close with each other.
Now that would be an honor, and I understand that completely.
Yeah, it's
now, that's
it's
your entry point.
Yeah, it's a club. I'm not in that club. I always went in as a performer and a writer. So, but there are people who are in that doorman club, and like the comedian who just passed away, Tim Jones. Tim was part of that. Joey's part of that. Sam Kinison was part of that. Blake Clark is part of that crew who were doormen. A lot of people. Mitzi was, Mitzi would start you out. If you didn't come to her as an act but that's what she wanted to do. She was very generous. She gave people a chance. You know, she wasn't unapproachable. She gave people a chance. She gave me, listen, you guys know about Last House, but I've had most of my career in television and in comedy. That's where it came from. Everything that I've done in my career, aside from Last House, pretty much everything I've done, the seeds of it are in Mitzi's decision that in that moment to make me a regular. So I'm pretty fucking grateful.
Yeah, to say the least.
And let's help it, like, how many comedians can brag in their single years that they could go to a place where beautiful groupies are and do a silly frog impression and get maybe all the women they wanted?
How many people? Where else can you do that, right?
Yeah. Only
yeah,
you can say that. Say,
that's
yeah,
right.
I did the frog and all the women came to me.
I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. I'm telling you that to be 21 years old and to be having sex with women who wouldn't give you the time of day in high school all because you're in a stupid little movie, that sends the wrong fucking message, because all I kept thinking was, man, I really made a right career decision.
Now, I want to bring something up that hasn't been brought up yet. Okay, so Mitzi, you know, had all of these comedians. From what I understand, she also opened up an area of the store, comedy store, specifically for women comics.
Yeah, the Belly Room upstairs.
Okay, so talk a little bit about that.
Well, again, Mitzi recognized, you know, she was a visionary. She recognized that there was an element of the comedy world that wasn't being given its due, or and hadn't. So it was her version of affirmative action. You know, she said, okay, then I'll just have a place just for women. And we'll try to, you know, even it up here a bit. That's how she was. But Mitzi was all about the funny. She didn't really, you know, other than that, gender wasn't that important to her. She liked the funny.
So if you were funny, you had an in, and that's a great thing. You know,
yeah.
The other thing too that you know, along with the Belly Club, she also had nights for Hispanic comedians, LGBT. I mean,
yep.
She really opened up the area of comedy to various groups, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, I've seen that, and I never understood that. Why some people would see like a big element of money they can make by that, and they just leave that money on the table rather than taking it.
What's your question? Why people don't always take the money?
Yeah.
Well, no, I think what
trouble.
He's saying is why don't people see the opportunities like she did?
Well,
yeah.
You know, sometimes people just don't see it. That's the whole point of, you know, why everybody isn't the same. You know, I write jokes that people say, wow, I wish I would have thought of that. I've seen jokes that other people have written. I've said, gee, I wish I would have thought of that. So it's just the way it is. Mitzi's ability to look at someone and parse out, you know, does she think they have a future? All subjective, of course, but all she could do was give you time to develop. If you didn't put the work in, you didn't put the time in, if you didn't take yourself seriously, then quickly you fizzled out, and somebody else caught her attention.
Right.
She's willing to give people a chance. If you played it right, she's willing to, you could get a chance from her. But once you had the chance, then the pressure is on you to deliver.
Right.
So that's all any of these places are. They're just an opportunity for people to develop and to see what they have. And for that, they're terrific. But if you don't have anything, you rarely move on.
Or you get people to find one bit of comedy that works and they milk that to death rather than trying to find any new jokes.
That's an absolutely solid point. People get stuck, you know, and don't grow. And they, you know, I saw that happen a lot. Somebody would put together a really good 15 minutes, but that's all they had. You know, they got so wrapped up in being so happy with that that they never progressed. They never continued to develop. But that's natural.
You know,
it happens.
The mindset of a stand-up comedian and what they have to go through is really, really difficult. I don't know if anyone really realizes if they haven't tried it. How difficult it is.
You know, you say when you say difficult, tell me what you mean by that, because I'll tell you.
It's a matter of not only coming up with material, but it's also having a very, very thick skin to deal with the audience reaction or non-reaction to your jokes, and being able to get up again and say, fuck it, I'm going to do this again and do it right or do it better. You know, it's that type of commitment to the art.
Well,
you know, just like, you know, a musician has to practice or, you know, or, you know, whatever the case would be, you know. But to me, and I, you know, we've talked about this. I actually was up on stage a couple of times. I couldn't do it, and I knew I couldn't do it.
But it's you say it's a commitment to the art, and I do agree with you, but I look at it differently. I don't know what to do with myself if I don't write jokes. Like, and I've always been like that. So when I got to the Comedy Store, I felt at home. I felt among my peers, among people who shared at least one common gene that I had. You know, so yeah, it's tough. And the way you develop the thick skin you're talking about, you know,
right.
It's not so much a thick skin. You just learn to always be funny. you just learn to always have something ready to go, you know. Sometimes it doesn't work, you know, but you get to a point where it not working, it still works. It just doesn't work as well as you thought it did, or it doesn't work as well as other stuff. Because if you get to a certain point and you still don't know what's really funny, you might as well fucking get another job because you're not making any progress. Part of the training, part of what you go through is to learn the difference between what you think is funny and what is actually funny.
Right.
Okay? So once you start to develop that particular muscle and you start to exercise that muscle, then your bar, your own internal bar, gets set much higher. So then you start to eliminate the shit that may, you know, be funny for 10 seconds but really isn't funny. But,
right.
So you learn how to calibrate yourself differently.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense to you guys?
It's still an amazing thing to me as I look at it because I've always been in awe of stand-up.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, it's like...
I think I've told Carl this before, but Larry David, I've heard a million stories where he's one of the funniest writers out there. He wrote Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm. But there's so many stories of him just walking out on stage, not even telling one joke. And he's out there for 5 seconds, and he just basically goes, oh, fuck it, and just walks off stage. Where he psyched himself so much that his routine is going to suck that he destroys himself before he even goes out on stage.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I know. I've never seen that. So, and I've seen Larry before.
It's just him.
I don't know. I think everybody, mostly everybody who laughs and stays and has a real career, goes up on stage and knows that they want to get laughs. That's their thing.
Yeah.
You know, nobody really goes up on stage to not get laughs. That's you gotta know. You know, it's like you were saying about how hard it is. My friend Joey Gaynor, who I mentioned before, tells a story about a conversation he had with Steve Landesberg. You guys know who Steve is, right?
I love Steve Landesberg.
Okay, Steve was a terrific,
great character.
Sadly, has passed away, but he was a sweet guy. He's a terrific guy. And Joey was first starting at the Comedy Store, and Mitzi was going to put him up on a Monday night, and he was going over his material with Steve, and he said to Steve, "I have 5 minutes. Is that enough?" And Steve says, "It's a fucking eternity if you're not funny." Yeah, and that's the story that Joey tells. That's the advice Steve gave to him. He said, "Yeah, 5 minutes is it's a fucking eternity if you're not funny." So, listen, it's all about, you know, you learn little things. It's about controlling the narrative. I tell you something that Robin Williams used to do. You guys have all you've both been to comedy clubs, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what happens is that there's an MC on stage. One act leaves, the audience is applauding, the audience calms down. Then the MC starts to introduce the next act. He introduces the next act. The comedian or comedienne walks to the stage, takes the microphone. They exchange some pleasantries. That the MC leaves, and the comedian starts his or her act. Is that pretty much the way it goes?
More or less.
Okay. When Robin Williams was on, when he was working, the original room at the Comedy Store, the comedian would be up on stage finishing. He leaves the stage. The MC walks to the stage. And just as the audience calms down quietly enough to listen to the MC, Robin, from the back of the room, would start doing some silly Shakespearean soliloquy or some dialect, or he'd yell, he's complete, like an old man, he's complaining about something. He would get everybody's attention, and then he would walk to the stage doing stuff like that, and by the time he got up onto the stage and went to the microphone, he had the audience in his pocket. And what that is he controlled the narrative from before the first moment. And it was just fucking brilliant to see him do that. It was just like fucking amazing. But it was an understanding of a theatrical technique of controlling the audience, controlling the narrative. Fascinating. People were
absolutely
just laughing, but I knew he was taking control of the audience. Yeah, and that's what it's all about. They want you to have control of them. They're there. They're sitting there. Okay. To give themselves up to you. You just have to take it. You have to get control of it.
Yeah, it's, you know, getting back to Mitzi and that's, you know, just the whole store and the whole vibe. You know, we were talking about how, you know, she was considered, you know, Ma, you know, I mean, and she was a mother figure. But there was so much more to it than that, you know. And we've touched on her chutzpah and her vision and that sort of thing. Do you have anything else to add to that at all, Mark?
I think that in the history of Hollywood, she has made as much of a contribution to the entertainment business as any studio head, as any network president, as any talent agent, as anyone, as any actor. She's, you know, her place gave birth to a generation of American comedy. You know, there's no denying that. It's a matter of fact. It's a matter of absolute fact.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, so.
Without a doubt. You know,
too,
there were.
If
you're a fan of early 90s noir, like The Usual Suspect, Heist, and a few more, you would think But Kevin Meaney was one of our great noir actors. He started out at the Comedy Store.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael Keaton started out as a comedian.
Right.
Yeah.
Michael Keaton was part of our crew. So,
I mean, you can't understate that. That's why I brought up the writers, too. Because you take a look at the whole breadth of entertainment since the 70s and what Mitzi, brought with the Comedy Store. And there were other places. There was the Improv. There was Catch a Rising Star, which was, of course, East Coast. I knew that place rather well. But nothing seemed to be more...
But nobody had a crystal ball. Everything was just day-to-day. It's just, if you look back historically, those days became really special. But it was just our lives. You know what I mean? It was just our daily life.
Yeah, you make it
and
sound
really,
mundane.
Comedy Store was considered the Valhalla of comedy.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I remember, like, my daily life was, I would get up, I'd wake up around 11 o'clock, noon, smoke a joint, go down to Schwab's Pharmacy to the food counter, have a breakfast with like Johnny Dark and Murray Langston and a couple of other people, go home, smoke another joint, write some jokes, take a nap, wake up, take a shower, smoke a joint, have something to eat, or go out somewhere to eat, and end up at the Comedy Store around 8:30, and there my night would start. Then the real day begins. And I would end up 2 or 3 in the morning in one of 3 or 4 food places, Cantor's or the Hyatt. There was a hotel next to the Comedy Store. It used to be called the Sunset Hyatt House. They had an all-night coffee shop. There was a place called Ollie Hammond's. There was a place called Theodore's. We'd end up packed there. But I'd be sitting there going over punchlines and jokes with Letterman and Leno, and Robin would pop in occasionally, and Dreesen was there, and Kippadotta, and George Miller. And I mean, I kept thinking to myself, what a fucking life this is. This is, like, seriously fucking great. And then I'd go home, go to sleep, wake up, do the same thing all over again the next day.
God damn.
I know.
I envy you.
It's like fucking...
Without a doubt.
It's fucking... When I think about what I did and who I did it with and, what my daily life was like, it just fucking amazes me.
Wow.
It just amazes me. That I actually...
So that does bring up a question, Mark. What was the time frame that you were really involved in the Comedy Store?
From 76 until 82.
Okay.
82, 83. Then I started writing really seriously. Real soon I was working like as a staff writer on some variety shows and some other shit. And so I was supplementing my income and still doing stand-up. And that couple of years passed, and I started to get some very serious writing jobs. And then I just couldn't split the two.
Okay.
So what was the last time you were up on stage?
Wait, Carl, this is important.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Were you still working there when the whole protest happened over Mitzi's policy of not paying the comics because they were getting an education on how to do comedy? Were you still deep in the scene when that happened, or were you already out?
Oh, no, that was in 79. I was right in the middle of it.
Okay.
Yeah. I just, look, in retrospect, with the benefit of hindsight, it was just a moment in time. I think that it was good for the comedians because we became like we got $15, I think, for a set, something like that. And but I became what's known as an original paid regular from the Comedy Store, which is kind of nice. And, you know, the dire thing, the Comedy Store actually didn't fall apart and didn't go broke. It actually became better and bigger, and, you know, it's now on legendary status, like with Universal Studio, you know, with the Universal Tour. So it's a destination. It's a place. It's a real iconic Los Angeles thing. Same with the Improv. Bud and Mark just sold the name and all their holding to some company, and I don't know the numbers, but there's no doubt it was quite good for them. So the fact that they ended up having to pay everybody a paltry amount didn't, in the historical sense, didn't harm them. It helped them. It just, you know, it helped everybody. Nobody ever got rich working, doing sets at the Comedy Store or the Improv, even after the pay, because you can't, but you can get a little self-esteem, you know,
yeah.
And that never hurts anyone.
And again, it's not just self-esteem. It's not just self-esteem. It's you know, the contacts and getting something from the contacts and all that. It's an electric place for that.
Yeah, but you have to look at, you know, nothing ever stays the same. Everything's always moving. Just some things move slower than others. So this was just an evolution. This was just a thing. It was like a blip on the evolution. The world of comedy was not hurt by this move, not in any way. The Comedy Store wasn't hurt, and the comedians weren't hurt. Everybody was helped. So I look at it, it turned out to be a good thing.
Yeah.
How come the Comedy Store never had a TV show? Because I can remember during the 80s, there was A Night at the Improv. Catch the Rising Star was Showtime's go-to comics they had there.
I think Mitzi dabbled in it initially, and I think she then decided that she preferred. I think. I don't know for sure. But I have heard that she wanted to just keep it purer than, you know, she wanted to just, you know, she just liked the club. She liked what she built.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
The Arts and Entertainment Network, if they didn't have night at the whatever night it was,
Evening at the Improv.
I think it was Saturday Night at the Improv.
Yeah, Evening at the Improv.
They wouldn't have got started.
Yeah, maybe.
No.
That was
maybe
the biggest
show.
Well,
you know, that's certainly
true
of HBO too.
Yeah.
In the early HBO comedy specials. And of course, then there's Dangerfield and what he did.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. It really
yeah.
is.
Who would have
you know,
we could tell somebody, but who would have thought that 5 minutes on something like the Dangerfield special could make someone's career just with that?
Yeah, well.
Well, you know, you were talking about actors, and now this was on one of the Dangerfield, and I think it was the first one that Robin Williams was on. But Tim Thomerson was a comedian first before he became an actor.
Tim Thomerson.
Yeah, Tim Thomerson.
Yeah.
Or Thomerson.
Yeah, Tim.
Yeah.
Thomerson. Yeah, I know Tim. Yeah, he was already a comedian working when I got to the store. He was one of the first regular guys that went, you know, once I started to hang out there every night, he was one of the guys, you know, that I would watch. He was a terrific impressionist. He did great impressions. And he's a good guy, too.
Yeah, yeah. Just, and of course, you know, with our podcast, we absolutely love that man. You
yeah,
know, with all
good.
That he's done and genre films and such. But I'll never forget his stagecoach routine.
Yes.
I mean, amazing.
Great faces, doesn't he? Makes incredible faces.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he and another section of that, he looks exactly like Charles Bronson ordering the burritos at McDonald's.
His Charles Bronson impression is the best one I've ever seen. Yeah, I was just about to say that. He blew me away. You know, one of the things that intimidated the crap out of me was that once I got into the Comedy Store, you know, after like I did one Monday night and they just kind of let me in so
right.
I could hang out. So I started watching comedians, you know, Tim Thomerson, Steve Bluestein, and these were guys who had been doing acts for a long time, so they were nailing it. And I was thinking to myself, wow, these guys are fucking good. Whoa, I got to be that good, huh? Okay, they were fucking great.
Oh yeah,
yeah, George Miller. I mean, talk about that's the most intimidating thing in the world. Wasn't Mitzi okay? Mitzi wasn't intimidating. What was intimidating to me, creatively, was, you know, I had just seen Monday Night Comedians, and I wasn't that impressed until I became a regular, and I started to see just how good you had to just be a regular, you know, and that if I didn't get that good quickly, I was fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was fucked. I'd be in and out.
Damn.
And I wouldn't have a career.
That really separate the men from the boys.
Oh no, say. That's the thing. That let me tell you something. I remember standing on stage at the Comedy Store on Monday nights and feeling a certain way. And then I remember how different I felt when my name was on the board and I was on the show and I was an act being, and I had 15 minutes. I remember just how different that was. And the only, and as I was explaining it to you, I was trying to think of a metaphor to come up and say what it's like. And it'd be the difference in playing like the Little League Championship in Dodger Stadium or playing in a major league game in Dodger Stadium.
Right.
You're in the same venue, but the rules are a little different. You know,
mm-hmm.
and the dynamic is different. You're in a major league game. You're in a major league game, and that's what I realized I was. And it you either step up or step out.
So I have a question for you. There's a
sure.
book that was written about the Comedy Store in the 70s called I'm Dying Up Here by William...
Right, that's the center of the Showtime series.
Yeah. Are you mentioned in that or
I have no idea. No one knows.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Okay.
Have you got to see any of the show?
I've watched a little bit of it.
What did you think?
I don't think it's as funny as it could be. I remember those days not being so dark. I remember them being very bright and enjoyable and fun. And
well,
I find
an episode the other night, and it was more focused on who's screwing who than
yeah,
on comedy or writing jokes or something like that.
Yeah, I have a joke. It said, you know what they call a comedy writer who isn't funny?
I don't know what.
A bartender.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm not one to criticize other people's work because, you know, just getting a show made is an incredible achievement. But I just somehow wish it was funnier. And I wish it was, I just wish it reflected the fun part of those times.
Yeah, that's a problem I had with the Sally Field movie from the 80s, Punchline, too. It wasn't funnier.
Yeah, again, if you're doing something about comedy, it needs to be funny.
Yeah.
It just needs to be funny, because if it's not funny, it's fucking drama. And we have way too much of that.
Well, you know, why do you go to a comedy
to laugh?
Or what, you know, comedy club. You go there to laugh and forget what the fuck is going on in your life that makes it suck.
Yeah, you go there to laugh. You go there to be, you know, laughter is a uniquely human experience. You know, it's the ability to, you know, to juxtapose language and physicality and draw laughter out of people is a uniquely human thing.
Yeah.
It's what makes us different as people. It's why laughter is important.
Amen.
Absolutely.
I mean, just think about it. It's a commodity. It's worth money. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It's an intellectual concept. It's an emotional / intellectual concept that can be monetized.
Wow. Never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right.
The moment that me and Carl treasure the most is when we break somebody or break each other and they just die for 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's a glorious moment.
Hey, listen, my wife tells me all the time, if I wasn't funny and I didn't know how to cook, she'd be out of here.
Well, I wish I could find a woman like that, and I'd be okay.
She tells me all the time. She says, if you weren't funny, and you know, the problem is that nobody ever has made me laugh the way you do, and if you weren't so damn funny and couldn't cook, I'd be gone. What would I need you for? And I say, yeah, you're right.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice.
And, Carl, you couldn't handle
a
woman
like that.
You're too masculine for your own good.
I think we missed that a little bit, Steve.
What I said is you couldn't hang with a woman for being you funny because you're too masculine for your own good.
You're talking to me, right?
Yes, you. Mr.
Oh, okay.
Keeping a copy of Venus and Furs under your pillow.
No, it's not under my pillow. It's under the bed. It's never mind. But I think, you know, as we look at someone like Mitzi, you know, it's just an amazing, amazing amount of influence. And I'm sure there are several comedians just absolutely, you know, and we all should be mourning her passing. You know, because we're really missing something, someone special.
Look, everybody, you know, I've been talking to some of the guys on Facebook, and everybody's got their own stories, but all their stories are fundamentally the same. You know, I met Mitzi, and she thought I had something, and she gave me a shot. And that's what everybody, it all boils down to those things. And that's it. She could have said no to me. She could have, you know, it's like Match Point, you know, Woody Allen's Match Point. It's wherever the ball hits the net, and the rest of your life depends on which way the ball, which side of the court the ball falls on. So I took a shot. Could have gone the other way. She could have said, no, you're not ready. No, you know, don't bother me. Get the fuck away from me. She could have said any number of things, but she didn't.
Do you think she actually was sort of judging comedians who had the chutzpah to come up to her and ask her that was part of the training too?
I think, you know, listen, if you want to know the truth, in my personal situation, I think that there was a magic moment that I had to either take advantage of or not take advantage of. And I think that Mitzi appreciated acts that had balls. So
yeah.
So remember that audience was applauding. The room was packed. The audience was applauding. I was already represented by William Morris. Clearly, they saw something in me. You know, there were lots of things going on that made it a chance for me to seize that moment and do something with it. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, my calculation, I don't think that I even calculated anything or that I even analyzed it the way I'm telling you guys about it, rather than I just, you know, my dad was an aluminum siding salesman, so he taught me a lot of things that became instinctual about how to get my way. And I just figured the audience, I did say to myself that walking off the stage, because I had a really, the audience was great that night, and I had a really, really good set, and I kept thinking to myself, wow, it's not going to get better than this. This is as good as it's ever been. And it's not, and I don't see it getting better in 5 minutes. There she is. What the fuck? You know, that's about as close as I came to thinking about it.
Gotcha.
But it was a real what the fuck moment, you know. And from her side, you know, she sees this kid walk off the stage. The audience is laughing. The material was good. He's got William Morris as an agent. He's, you know, he's got a career. Oh, what the fuck? I'll give him a chance. I mean, I don't think it was any monumental decision, because, you know, if I turned out to be shit, she would have just, you know, thrown me out the door.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen, so.
No.
No, she was always nice.
What happens when you get your shot? You either take it or you're going to spend your life regretting it.
Yeah, she was always nice to me and never gave me a hard time and never always was pleasant. You know, I didn't know her the best. I didn't, you know, didn't really socialize a lot with her outside of the club. But in that venue, in that environment, in that dynamic, she was always very nice to me.
Very cool. Very cool.
So,
you know who I really felt sorry for when I heard the news? And I think
Pauly?
People really meant said anything to him, and that's Pauly Shore.
Yeah.
You guys called him, Mom. Pauly, he actually really did lose his mom.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, they were close. Yeah. I mean, Pauly I knew when he was a little kid running around the store.
What do you think will happen now? As far as the ownership, will Pauly take it over, or
I think Pauly owns it now.
Okay.
I think that's the way it is. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's the way it is.
So that the comedy store will still exist.
I would hope so too. I would certainly hope so.
After running around the comedy store as much as he did, I hope he learned. Well, he probably has learned just from osmosis being around what's good, what's not.
I think he does. Look, I don't know Pauly well, but I kind of know him, and he seems like, you know, on the personal side to be a decent kid. I know he was very close with his mother, and I think that. You know, I would hope that he would just want to keep his mother's legacy going.
And that's what I think will happen.
I think.
Isn't already.
Yeah. I think so. I think so.
So I was just thinking, you know, of all the people that you interacted with in the comics that you saw there. You know, we talked a little bit about Tim Thomerson. Are there any others from that period that just you have some stories of, or another story about Mitzi or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You mean stories that I would tell?
Okay, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Stories that you would tell while you're alive.
Robin Williams one night, pre-Mork and Mindy, we were at Sunset, and he had a spot in Westwood at the Westwood store. This was like 12, and he had a 12:45 spot. And he had lent his car to someone, and they didn't bring it back. and he was getting nervous, and he said to me, I hate to ask, but could you give me a ride to Westwood? So I said, yeah, sure. So I drove to the Westwood store with him, and we talked, and we walked in, and it was like 12:45, you know, and there were three people in the audience. And Robin got up on stage and did exactly the same show that he did for three people as he would do for, you know, 103 people. So on the way back, I said to him, I said, you did a great show. And he was very sweet and kind and humble. And he said, oh, thanks, man. And I said, no. I said, what really impressed me was you did the same show for those three people that you would do for 103 people. And he looked at me innocently and said, well, you gotta. And I took a great lesson from that. And that lesson was, you can't get mad at the three people who showed up for the 97 people who didn't.
Right.
You know, you're either performing cause for the love of performing, or, you know, you're trying to stroke your ego. And Robin was a guy who performed for the love of performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very apparent with Robin. I mean, you could see
the
joy.
Purest I've ever seen. Not always the funniest, you know, not always the absolute funniest, but as far as performing is concerned, purest I've ever seen. Just, you know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Stephen, anything else you wanna bring up, or? I think we've pretty much covered.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, when I seen that she died, to me, it was really like an era dying, because I was like a 10 when you really start seeing the comedy boom on TV and stuff, the half-hour comedy hour, and you would see all these news reports on 20 and 20 stuff on Catch a Rising Star, the Comedy Storm stuff. It was like, you know, like these holy places where you would go to be funny or to laugh.
Yep. And they were the natural progeny of like clubs in Greenwich Village and in San Francisco and in Chicago, these little, you know, used to be like jazz comedy clubs. The kind of clubs
right.
that Lenny
Hungry Eye would be one.
Hungry Eye, right. The kind of clubs that Lenny Bruce came out of.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And those were like either
Richard
jazz clubs or strip
clubs. Why did he test jokes at the Comedy Store? He's like, that's one of the few places that a comedian could go up there and just totally flop with a joke. But then he tells one more after that, and it's a good one. He can have them all right back in his pocket again.
Yep. All right, boys, I'm going to take my nap.
Okay. Well, take your nap. But what? Right before you leave, I just
one
more. So we also lost another comedian this week, and I'm going to be doing a little tribute to him tomorrow. And I just wondered if you had ever met or seen Chuck McCann and what your thoughts were with Chuck McCann. Now, he's more of an East Coast.
Well, I knew Chuck McCann back in New York, and then I, of course, knew him when he moved out here. He was a lovely, you know, I keep saying about people, I try not to hang out with assholes, so mostly the people I know and we'll talk about are nice people. Chuck was a sweetheart. He was just a nice, he was that friendly, smiling guy that people imagine him from, you know, the zillions of commercials and appearances that he's done. He was a lovely man.
Yeah.
And I have one last one, and this is important. Is there any recorded footage of your stand-up besides the two little bits of the frog and you screwing around with the dipstick on Last House on the Left?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. There's some new footage of me and, you know, and some new stuff I'm doing, but it's just for me. It's just for my study, not for anyone else.
You greedy bastard.
Well, you know, if you ever want to try out new material, you can come on the podcast and do it for us.
Yeah, I prefer live performance. I prefer live performances in front of audiences. That's
okay. Well, then we just have to come to your place.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Good talking to you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark.
Okay. You guys have a good one. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
What was the club called that you wrist opened mic night on?
That was at Catch a Rising Star in New York in the 70s. I mean, in the 80s, excuse me. Two times. And both of them were at like 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, with drunk patrons and lots of heckling. And after the second time I tried it, I said, no, I'm not dealing with this. I don't have the 16.
I love you, man, but you couldn't handle the hecklers. And I couldn't either, because I would be like, Lou, I would be like your boy without the funniness.
Bill Hicks.
I'd be like Bill Hicks handling a heckler, but not funny.
Right. And I'd be just crying in the corner. Because I did that.
Yeah, I'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah, seriously.
But
you know, the interesting thing for me is, you know, like tomorrow in church, we're having this service, which is, you know, laughing at the devil. And so it's all jokes. So today, I didn't even tell Mark this. My pastor and I were writing comedy routines. So we're going to be doing a whole comedy routine tomorrow in church.
Awesome.
Now, of course, it's clean. But, yeah, we actually wrote a couple of jokes.
Well, can I quote something that Kevin Smith said? He had more fun writing the jokes for Clerks, the television series, than he did with any of his movies.
Right.
Because it was harder
to
be clean, and you had to be funnier clean than you would dirty.
Mm-hmm. So here, I'll give you one. Okay. Now, remember, this is in church, so it is religious to a certain degree. So, do you know who the best female financier is in the Bible?
No, who?
Well, it's Pharaoh's wife, because she went to the banks of the Nile and drew out a little prophet.
Hey, that was actually a good one.
Yeah, we came up with that today.
Yeah, that was a good one.
The thing is, I'll give a shout out to my pastor, whose name is Joel Biggers. Mm-hmm. Joel and I are going to be leaving this church shortly. But they have a nickname for us at the church. And we are the bad boys of Watchung. The church is Watchung Avenue Presbyterian Church.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're the bad boys. And we are. We are, without a doubt.
And I would like
to
talk about two more people that died today. One, well, you got to go back in the 70s, and there was Heineken's Chariots of the Gods and all, Blood and Blue Book.
Not Heineken, Von Däniken. Von Däniken. Heineken is beer.
Yeah, Von Däniken. Yeah, Chariots of the Gods and all that. And from that came a little show that started out on the West Coast called Coast to Coast with Art Bell. And it became nationwide. He became like one of the focal points in the UFO Bigfoot movement. And it doesn't matter how crackpot your theory was, Bell would have you on and he would let you say it.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean,
it's one of those things. If you
really heard
he was up at, yeah, it's one of those that your generation would stay up. If you're up at 2 a.m., you light your herbal substances, and then you would listen to him. And as I put on my wall today, the theme song that he used for his show was the opening from Children of the Sun.
Nice.
Yeah. And the second one is someone that, well, 99% of people will know for two movies at the least, right, Carl?
Well, there's a little more than two movies, but I know what you're going to say. So go ahead, and then I'll add a couple.
I'm just saying 99% of the people would know him for just two movies.
Right. I agree.
And that would be Milos Forman. And the two movies people would know him for is Amadeus, which I love for that amazing. It gave us F. Murray Abraham.
Yes, he did.
And
then,
man,
of course, One Flew
him.
Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah. Which was his first film after leaving Czechoslovakia. And how many films did he make over there?
No, it's not the first film. It's not the first film.
What was the first
film? His first
film
after leaving Czechoslovakia was Taking Off, and that was 1971.
Okay.
Previous, when he
What's
was
that?
In, he did The Fireman's Ball, and he did another one, and I can't remember what it was. But he did about three films in Czechoslovakia. Then he came to the U.S. when that was taken over by Russia. In 1971, he did Taking Off. I think he did one other, and then it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 75.
Yeah. He's done a lot of films, but the ones that my favorite one of his, Carl ain't going to be surprised when I say it, but I don't know if Carl loves it as much as I do, and that would be The People versus Larry Flint.
Are you kidding? I fucking love that movie.
Yeah.
I love
that
movie.
That was basically his last. I don't know if he made anything else,
because after that, he did the Jim Carrey one where he was playing Andy
Kaufman.
Man
on the Moon.
Yeah.
Oh, never mind. I love that one, too.
Also gave us Hair.
Hair. Great movie, but they made it too late, as we've gone into death before.
But you know, Milos Forman was an absolute fantastic director, and not extremely prolific. He only did about, I think, less than 10 films altogether.
Yeah.
But what he did was quality. Probably his most underrated film is Valmont, which is a variation on Dangerous Liaisons, but Liaisons had come out earlier, and his movie was kept back because of that, and so it didn't get the notoriety. But I actually like that film better than Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah, it's a better version of Les Liaisons Dangerous or Dangerous Liaisons.
Mm-hmm.
It's the better version, but the one Malkovich got more hype, and I didn't like Dangerous Liaisons.
Mm-hmm. No,
I really can't say why. I just didn't like it. It just seemed too Hollywood, and
Yeah. Whereas his version was a lot, in a lot of ways, a lot
darker.
Meaner.
Yeah.
And darker. Because
in Dangerous Liaisons, they perceived the Valmont as a heroic kind of motherfucker.
Not in this one.
A Sim Tom Jones-like character. And really, he's a scumbag. He steals virtue from the Uma Thurman's character and stuff. And he only messes with the people just for the meanness of it.
Exactly. But yeah, Milos Forman was a great director. For those who want to, what I would do is go to his IMDb page and go to his early Czechoslovakian material, and particularly The Fireman's Ball. And
that
check
was easy
those
to get because it's still in print from Criterion. I don't know if they've upgraded in the Blu-ray yet.
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is.
But the DVD
I'm not
is still
sure
in
about
print.
It. Okay.
But the DVD is still in print.
Right. Okay. And I'm sure if you go to Film Threat or not Film Threat, what do they call that? The streaming service of film that Criterion's involved with, you could probably find it there too.
I forget what it is, but yeah, they probably have it on Criterion streaming channel.
Right. And the other thing is, if you can't afford it, go to your library. Trust me, I'm a big, big proponent of going to your local library and finding films.
Yeah. So. Let's just say Carl going to the library and finding what they had there on DVD was like a junkie finding a free source of heroin.
Yes, absolutely. Or cheese.
Yeah.
Almost as good as cheese.
But
again, it was really nice to have Mark on the show.
He was there. Like you said, he was there. I'm jealous of you guys both. He was there in the comedy club, and you was there in New York doing.
I didn't make the turn into what Mark does. Unfortunately, you know,
matter.
I
you
always seem to be
the
on
last...
the outside looking in a bit, but. Still,
you wasn't on the outside looking in. You was in the middle of the last interesting period of New York. It doesn't matter. You didn't make it in the big time. You were there. All the restaurants that you probably was on went to, gone. All the movie theaters mm-hmm. you went to, gone. All the little boroughs and stuff that you lived in, gone.
Yeah, very true.
None of us can experience that life anymore.
Yeah, you have a point. You have a point. But again, we did this particularly for Mitzi, and we were very, very happy that Mark was with us. And as I said, tomorrow we will do a quick segment on Chuck McCann, who I just adored. I love that man. Loved him.
And we're going to be talking about the new generation of blaxploitation that's coming out.
And who's
going to
be there with us?
What?
Who's going to be there with us? You, me, and Doc?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we're pretty much not going to have anything till next Sunday, which will be the annual Drive-In Superama show.
And that's going to be really good.
It always is. And we're going to have the usual suspects here.
And then Tuesday, not this coming Tuesday, but a week from Tuesday, we're going to be doing part two of my Jewish shows, and we're going to be focusing on films that depict the Holocaust. And so we're going to be talking about those films. Just this week, it was... National Holocaust Remembrance Day. And so we're doing it for that, even though it'll be a little late, but nonetheless.
Well,
so
I'll
we're
be on the
do
road
that
Tuesday. I'll be headed up to Pittsburgh as usual.
Right. So we can't do it Tuesday. But we can do it next Tuesday.
And,
so that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and on May Day, we'll be doing our annual Officer Neil Halley Memorial, except that we're going to tackle it from this year. Well, we've done the movie, we've done the music, now we're going to get into the fairy tale and folktale aspects of the movie. We're going to be talking about that and other movies that focus on, you know, the folktales.
By the way,
Once Upon
Steve,
a Time crap.
Steve, and I'll actually message you on this. But you have homework, okay? You need to see a movie called Tale of Tales.
Yeah.
I just watched it last night on Brian's recommendation, Brian Harris.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. And it's all folk tales from the Renaissance period by this particular author, Jean-Baptiste Bastille. Who was an author of folk tales and fairy tales. So, that was really good. And that's just a couple years old then. I think it's 2016.
Yeah, we'll be talking about films like that, Borachek's Immoral Tales,
Company of Wolves.
Company of Wolves, the Decameron, Canterbury Tales.
We'll be mentioning
the Devil's Widow, a.k.a. Tamlin.
And of course, we can't do the show without mentioning our favorite, which is the Wicker Man, and Sergeant Howie. It is in his honor that we are doing this.
So I'm still going to be busy. I hope you enjoyed last night, and I hope you enjoyed tonight, and it makes you want to go listen to a lot of old comedy, which you should.
Absolutely. And with that, shall we call it a night, sir?
Yeah. With that, good night. God bless.
Oh, wait a second. Wait a second. We can't.
What?
Because I got to do this. So we're talking about the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
And just before we go off the air, I want to give you a list of people, notable alumni of the Comedy Store. And of course, Mark Scheffler is mentioned. But let's give you a couple more than a couple. Tim Allen, Louis Anderson, Roseanne Barr, Joy Behar, John Belushi, Richard Belzer, Sandra Bernhard, Mike Binder, Elaine Boozler, David Brenner, George Carlin, Jim Carrey, Johnny Carson, Dave Chappelle, Chevy Chase, Margaret Cho, Louis C.K., Tom Davis, Andrew Dice Clay, Dane Cook, Blake Clark, Billy Crystal, Rodney Dangerfield, Ellen DeGeneres, Andy Dick, Tom Dreesen, Red Fox, Al Franken, Gallagher, Janine Garofalo, Whoopi Goldberg, Kathy Griffin, Arsenio Hall, Chelsea Handler, Kevin Hart, Bill Hicks, Joel Hodgson, Dom Herrera, Martin Lawrence, Andy Kaufman, Michael Keaton, Sam Kinison, Steve Landisberg, Jay Leno, David Letterman, Bill Maher, Howie Mandel, Mark Maron, Steve Martin, Ralphie May, Jason Mewes, Dennis Miller, George Miller, Paul Mooney, Eddie Murphy, Rosie O'Donnell, Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, Ray Romano, Bob Saget, Amy Schumer, Jerry Seinfeld, Gary Shandling, Pauly Shore, Sarah Silverman, Sinbad, Yakov Smirnoff, Kevin Smith, Doug Stanhope, the unknown comic, otherwise known as Murray Langston, Jimmy Walker, Damon Wayans, Robin Williams, and Thomas F. Wilson. I'm sure you all that I mentioned are in mourning for the passing of Mitzi Shore.
And with that, good night, God bless, and thank you for all of the great comedy, Mitzi.
Absolutely. Good night, people.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases. It's at full.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Blue Magneto's right. There's a war coming.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
You sure you're on the right side?